This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Meetings are held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify that a meeting is being held.
The 2024 election is coming, and we at KBOO want to make sure your voice is heard. Take KBOO's election agenda survey and help our volunteer reporters and programmers cover the 2024 election. We want to know, what do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Fill out our survey by August 14th and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card. Full rules on our website. At the end of August, we'll report back with the community's priorities. Find that survey online at bit.ly/KBOOSurvey2024. That's bit.ly/KBOOSurvey2024.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and the International Travel Group. KBOO Community Radio and ITG are organizing a journey to Cuba December 14th to the 21st. It is a guided exchange of music, history, and landscapes. ITG supports KBOO's mission of fostering community through diverse voices. More information at kboo.fm/Cuba.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Jan Hawkins speaks with Aiko Kojima Kabino, Laura Gluckman, and Yuki Miyamoto on the annual Day of Remembrance, Hiroshima Day, which is tomorrow, Tuesday, August 6. Then Bill Resnick will debate with Peter Sollenberger on the subject of how socialists should relate to the Democratic Party. First up, Jan Hawken talks with three educators from Chicago about the day the United States dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan in 1945. 3 days later, the U.S. again dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki, 15 days after World War II ended, and in 1946, Hiroshima Day began as a day of remembrance. Joining Jan are Aiko Kojima Kabino, Laura Gluckman, and Yuki Miyamoto to talk about their curriculum called the Paper Crane Project. Here's Jan Hawken for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour. Aiko Kojima Kabino, Laura Gluckman, and Yuki Miyamoto.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Well, tomorrow is Hiroshima Day, an annual day of remembrance for the victims of the nuclear attacks by the United States on Japan in 1945. The first bomb was dropped on Hiroshima on August 6th, and the second on Nagasaki on August 9th. Tens of thousands of people were killed or maimed in the immediate impact of the blasts, and tens of thousands more died or suffered illnesses in the aftermath. So the three of you, along with Jessica Kibble-White, designed a curriculum project that lays out a methodology for teaching nuclear history in K-12 classes as well as in higher education. So can each of you say a little about yourselves and how you came together to take on this project? Yuki, do you want to start?
Yes, thank you. I'm Yuki Miyamoto, and thank you, Jen, for mentioning August 6th and the 9th. Sometimes my students don't know the exact dates, and it's also a nice segue to myself, my introduction. I was born and grew up in Hiroshima, and my mother was a mile away from the hypocenter, and I grew up in witnessing her suffering from radiation illness. And she's not with us anymore. She passed away over 20 years ago, but that really impacted me. I don't want anyone to suffer from radiation exposure. And that's how I started teaching. That's how I chose this issue as my dissertation, and I've been teaching since then. So I started teaching courses, Atom Bomb Discourse, since 2003. And then I added Atomic Age Seminar since 2015. And also I'm leading study abroad project, taking DePaul students to Hiroshima and Nagasaki for 2 weeks since 2005, roughly speaking every other year. And as you know, last couple of years, I was not able to go to Japan. But now this year, we are able to resume this program. So I'm very excited. Thank you.
Are those students from DePaul University where you teach?
Yes.
Well, we look forward to hearing on that important field trip, study abroad trip on your return. Laura, say a little about your teaching and your interest in this project.
Sure. So I have been a teacher in Chicago Public Schools for about 14 years. And throughout my teaching, I have always wanted to build social justice-oriented and interdisciplinary learning experiences with my students. And I find it's so important to have action elements to my students' learning, whether it be in social science or science. And over the past 4 years, I've been teaching at National Teachers Academy for 5 years. And I had Aiko's son as one of my loved students. I mean, all of my students were loved for 2 years. And I began to be involved in this project because Aiko came to me with this idea of creating a curriculum centering on nuclear discourse and kind of interrogating the status quo take on nuclear issues that's often taught in high school through college, not really exposure in the middle school. So I was teaching sixth graders at the time when we began this project and working with them in science class to learn about nuclear energy, the science behind nuclear energy, and then begin to learn narratives of the experiences of people affected by nuclear technology and nuclear weapons. But this year was just an incredible experience because I've been able to build with students more and more knowledge about this discourse. And this year they've really showed up with incredible inquiry questions, and we did a lot of amazing work together. Work that is not only interdisciplinary, but also has done a lot of critical consciousness building for my students and the people that they've communicated their learning to.
So all of you challenge a certain commonly held belief that this is too serious and complicated a topic for kids to take on or for teachers to take on. Aiko, say a little about yourself.
Yes. Hi, I'm Aiko Kojima Hibino. I am a lecturer of sociology at School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And so I teach cultural sociology and political sociology courses. So I've been interested in and learning about the atomic bombings and nuclear history, mostly from Yuki and also Professor Norma Field at University of Chicago. I was her research assistant. So I was helping. She was also teaching a nuclear history course at University of Chicago. So I was, assisting her teaching. So I've read, you know, those literatures and watched, you know, documentaries and films and, you know, learned about it. But it was not my specialty, to be honest. You know, I was involved in the project, you know, or symposium, you know, helping those things, but more like an assistant. And actually, my specialty was the sociology of food. So I was, you know, researching about the safety of food in Japan. And then 2000, when I was, you know, doing my research, you know, the Fukushima nuclear power plant explosion happened that severely affected the safety of food supply in Japan. So that was the moment that really get me into this topic as my, you know, research interest and as a teaching interest. And so since then, you know, I was half research, but half activism, more supporting activism. Very much interested in those, you know, topic as a researcher, but also as a citizen and also as a mother. You know, Ms. Gluckman just told about my son. He was a baby back then. Then, long story short, I have many hats to wear, but I got involved in the advocacy of equitable public education activism in Chicago public school systems. And during that fight, I learned a lot about how the public education systems works in the city of Chicago, how it's different from in Japanese public education systems and all those things. And the school that my son went, where Ms. Gluckman was teaching, National Teachers Academy, was actually one of the front line of that, you know, fight back then. So I started reading those education specific, you know, news sources and materials a lot more. And then 2019, there is this online education newspaper called Chalkbeat. They issued a story about the dumpster outside of one of the Chicago public school high school. And the picture was the bunch of books was discarded in that big, huge dumpsters. So we assumed that that was dumped by that high school, but, you know, it was not confirmed, just to be clear. That picture was posted on social media, and that became like a huge controversy because Chicago Public Schools has been, you know, suffering from chronic budget cut. And so most of the schools don't have a librarians, and many students, the majority of the student body at Chicago Public Schools are low-income students who don't have, you know, the resources to buy books and things. So in that context, dumping the books, is it ethically allowed? Is it okay? Or, you know, so there is the controversy about the dumping books. Is it okay or not? Right. But what actually struck me about that picture is that there were only two kinds of books, hundreds of copies of one was Great Gatsby. And the other one, also the hundreds of copies of Hiroshima by Hershey. So,
and it also became a metaphor as well as a practical manifestation of discarded history.
Exactly.
And the valuing of schools that serve certain students.
Exactly. So we don't know that exact reason why those were discarded. And now, you know, many students read the books, you know, digitally. So maybe, you know, given that the librarian isn't there, they had to go with the digital so that they don't have to, you know, manage those books or whatever it is. It was just, you know, emotionally shocking. So yeah.
Was that important for this Teach Asian American History legislation that developed? Laura, do you want to say a little about that as well? Because you've been teaching middle schoolers.
Yeah, middle schoolers, fifth through eighth. Yes. So recently, teachers in all subject areas and all grade levels are mandated to teach Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander history. Not only history, but also activism and innovations and much more than tragedies that have happened to these communities. Although in our history teaching, especially at the middle school level, there's not much focused full unit planning on Asian American experiences. And so when Aiko and Yuki shared with me this kind of focused image object for us to build on, it really connected to not only this mandate for Illinois state educators and the fact that we don't have materials already in place or even curricular resources in place within Chicago Public Schools to teach the history of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or beyond the Japanese internment camps, for example. That history is not even being taught, and so we don't have those materials, but we also don't have materials readily available for us to teach about anything beyond those traumatic histories. And so what we wanted to do within this curriculum project is not only address the standards, the new standards, but also have a turn towards stories of resistance and stories of activism and stories of community care within Asian American and Pacific Islander histories, and do some revealing of the complexity of what has happened and how the effects of nuclear proliferation, and not just socioeconomically and politically, but also environmentally. And so I think, Aiko, you can address a little bit more about the work that you have done or communicated with organizations, activist organizations around the standards. But I do know, as a science educator primarily, not until recently was this something that was mandated or even explored as an important piece of student learning.
And you're all committed to a vision that goes beyond defining a group by remembrance of a horrific tragedy. And there's always that risk of remembering only through the death and destruction. As important as that is, there's also a living, vibrant, remaining history and multiple lessons that can be drawn from that history. Aiko, before you talk further about the curriculum, Yuki, could you say a little bit about the metaphor of the Paper Cranes Project, which is in memory, as I understand it, of one of the victims of those nuclear bombs, and how that became a metaphor for teaching in this area?
Yes, Sadako Sasaki, she was 2 years old, and she was also about a mile away from the hypocenter at the time of the bombing, but fortunately she didn't have any external injuries. So afterwards she was fine, and she was very active athlete. But 10 years later, which is actually the surge of leukemia in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and 10 years later after the bombing, she was diagnosed with leukemia. And then she was hospitalized, and her friends came from junior high school, and she believed in this kind of folkloric tale that if you fold 1,000 paper cranes, your dream will come true. So during the hospitalization, she was folding 10,000 paper cranes. And then there are some different versions. One says that she actually failed to reach 1,000, and others say she actually exceeded 1,000. But anyhow, she unfortunately passed away. And this is totally tangent, but my mom was 4 years older than her, and she went to the same junior high school. Interestingly, though, I was going to talk about, you know, how recent students don't know about Sadako's story. When I started teaching Sadako and John Hersey 20 years ago, one third or half of the students, let's say class of 40, knew about these stories or had read these stories before coming to college. But nowadays, it's only a couple of students in classroom.
These stories, can you say a bit more about what you see as the limited? Is it about the story of the paper cranes or the larger stories?
Right. And Aiko was talking about John Hersey's Hiroshima had been discarded. And also we are talking about Sadako's story, both stories, which I asked my students if they had known about these stories. And they usually, nowadays, there are very few students who know about these stories. But I like this symbol because, especially, even those students who know about Sadako's story, they sometimes forgot about the link to the atomic bombing. And this is about radiation exposure illness. So, you know, even if you think you survived, you never actually know once you are exposed to radiation. But sometimes when we talk about atomic bombing, radiation exposure is not necessarily emphasized. And even worse, the common prevailing understanding is trying to separate peaceful use of atomic energy and nuclear weapons. But I think this story nicely combines, actually, there is no differences between nuclear weapons and nuclear energy, especially when you pay attention to the process from the very beginning of uranium mining to the waste. So I think this symbol, even though it's closely connected with the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, however, it shows us actually it's about radiation exposure and its danger. So I think it's perfectly fit our project.
Yeah, and Aiko, you also came into this line of research as well as inquiry and teaching through food and the radioactive effects of the Fukushima disaster on food. And I think the Fukushima disaster is also very emblematic and known in the history of nuclear disasters, but not so connected with the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. How do you approach that intersection of nuclear technology, nuclear weapons, and nuclear power through the curriculum?
Yes, so I started teaching nuclear problems and society course 2 years ago, so after this project started. So in my sociology of food course, I have the week to discuss the radiation contamination of food, but just 1 week. So I didn't deal with that issue specifically throughout the course until 2 years ago. But just as Yuki said, because my more personal interest started from Fukushima, to me, the nuclear and atomic, you know, technology is always about radiation and its, you know, effect on human body's environment. And because of that, on the society and the local communities. Right. So this year, Ms. Glackman actually designed the teaching curriculum around the central questions that whose body, whose life is deemed dispendable. Right. And so that is a great way to connect all those seemingly different usage or some things that is a technology together. It actually, on the root, they're the same. Who is affected the most? Who is harmed the most? So this project, as I briefly said, that, you know, started with that, you know, Hershey's Hiroshima's image. And so we started more heavily with this history lessons on atomic bombing on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But with that, you know, question in mind, you know, especially this year, Ms. Glackman, you know, did a great job to expand this question to even more fundamental humanities questions and ethics questions. So this comes to, even though this project was also inspired by, you know, teaching Equitable Asian American Community History Act. So in that sense, this is very much an Asian American community and also as Pacific Islanders, right? So the lots of atomic bombing testing in Marshall Islands. So the history is very much, you know, connected with, you know, Asian American Pacific Islanders history. But we could also, this is a time that we are living that we question the historic narratives that had been understood as like a canonic national discourse, right? So that the Black Lives Matter, that's why we question the, you know, the Columbus and indigenous people's histories and their experiences. So this is a very critical moment, the learning and the reflecting, you know, how we came to this point. So this curriculum is not just only about Asian American history, but it's also about the human's histories. And through that inquiry, it's obvious that there is a pattern, right? Food is always deemed dispendable. So
yes, there's something, there's an immediacy and a sensual, palpable aspect of that focus on food and the body that is different from a lot of the scientific discourse around it, which often assigns the adjudication of issues to policymakers or experts who have to bring PhDs to the table in understanding it, that it's beyond ordinary people. So, Laura, can you expand on that point or say how you bring this issue as the nuclear history and the range of effects and uses of this technology, both the bomb and nuclear power, down to earth for students, and also keep as a central focus the social justice aspect of it, that all of you mentioned the differential impact of both nuclear power and nuclear weapons and testing. So how do you take that up as a social justice issue?
Yes, of course. So first, I just wanted to share how this has been just an incredible learning experience for me as an educator, but also as someone who was not steeped in this learning as a young person. And so the very act of learning alongside my students, learning to support the development of their experiences with the content and their own planning for their actions has been part of the point, too, of this work. Yuki, Aiko, and I have talked about how much we've learned from one another and from the young people that we're teaching. And so that sort of larger framing of this is also social justice, right? Because we are developing this fluidity of expertise between student, teacher, texts or people, experts that we've pulled information from or stories from, is a way to sort of dismantle more Western understanding of knowledge building. And that was a huge piece that I wanted for my classroom this year as well, just this overarching goal for students to begin to understand that knowledge building is about relationships and self-reflection and reformatting our relationships with the natural world, to be in many scholars, Indigenous scholars and Black environmentalist scholars, call being in right relationship with the world around us. And so some of those larger ethical questions that Aiko mentioned, what are our responsibilities as young scientists? Why are these issues important to us and relevant? And how are nuclear issues connected to our own experiences of environmental racism within our own city? How are resistance movements all interconnected? And how is care and deep questioning of the status quo, like I said before, part of our own growth as people? And as people, as scholars, as young action researchers, I know I've talked about the process of action research with you, Jan, and there have been many layers of action research in this curriculum project where the three of us have done research and have learned more from that research and in our own discussions together from one another towards putting into action what's happening in the classroom. And then my students and Aiko's and Yuki's students have done that flow of learning as well, where they're taking research and new learning and putting it into action through everything from art to scientific modeling to presentations for people outside of their school community to the possibility of reaching out to state legislators in Illinois.
So this is one way of helping students move beyond being passive recipients.
Yes.
Very scary, alarming information.
Exactly.
And that there are groups of people and as well as generations of people who push back and envisioned a different world. Before we close, Yuki and Aiko, I was wondering if you could each say a bit about your upcoming trip to Japan and whether some of these same themes the three of you raise in your project around nuclear as a social justice issue, who's most vulnerable, many Indigenous activists call the sacrifice zones here in terms of who pays the greatest cost for the destruction of the planet. What do you expect and perhaps hope to see dialogue around this issue in Japan? Because, of course, for many, it's surprising that the victims, the country that's a victim of the U.S. dropping of atomic bombs on this country, then later came to embrace nuclear power and continues to, even though they've suffered one of the most devastating nuclear accidents in its history. And that's maybe too big a topic to end on, but I'd like each of you just to say a bit about Japan. and the interest there among activists in these same issues that all of you take up in your teaching. Yuki, could you say a little first, and then we'll go to Aiko.
First of all, social justice issues. Laura earlier mentioned this, but Japanese Americans internment camp. Actually, Hiroshima has the most immigrants to Hawaii and to North and South America. So many people who were interned in the United States have relatives or even their parents and siblings in Hiroshima. And then 1929, the Great Depression took place, and the first migrant generation, they decided to send their kids back to their grandparents. So therefore, there were 4,000 Japanese Americans living in Hiroshima at the time of the bombing, roughly estimated. And also 10% of victims in Hiroshima bombing came from the Korean Peninsula, which tells us that Japan's colonization. So this is definitely an issue of colonialism. And also when we see in the United States, it's about settler colonialism, because uranium mines are mostly focusing on the indigenous people's residential areas. And given that, the Pacific Islands, which also during the war, Japan had colonized, but later on, the state's territories, for example, the Marshall Islands that Aiko mentioned earlier, 67 hydrogen bombs were detonated there. But one of the scientists, according to the recently declassified documents, one of the scientists says they, referring to the Marshallese, they are more like us than mice. And that's the kind of mentality that we are dealing with if that's actually in the past. And so that's the kind of social justice, environmental issues, and gender issues as well. As you know, United Nations Treaty of Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, it says that women and especially girls are more vulnerable to radiation exposure. And so this is also gender issues, racial issues, environmental issues, the negative legacy of colonialism. So definitely this is encompassing all those social issues. And then, however, your second question of Japan, it is not necessarily known much. In other words, Korean victims are not much known or recognized. And in Japan, many people don't know that there are victims in the United States. So if you have nuclear weapons or nuclear power, you definitely have people who are affected by those nuclear power plants or nuclear weapons facilities. However, unfortunately, it is not much known. So I would like to make a kind of bridge between these two countries. And of course, it's not limited to these two countries. I would like to see more friendship and collaborations among citizens, because the nuclear industry is so powerful. Therefore, we need to be connected and collaborated. And very lastly, very quickly, Aiko is being very modest, but she is the driving force of this project. And Laura is, every time I visit her class, I was just teary. Students were so responding, and she and her students' relationships are so beautiful. Thank you.
There's something that comes through to students about a level of commitment and caring and being able to withstand the political pressure that silences you. That's part of role modeling for students around taking on very hard topics, but not withering under the heat of it. So Aiko, can you say a little bit about this upcoming trip and your experiences in Japan? And maybe we can continue over time with some of those friendship gestures, talking across the Pacific with one another. What do you expect?
So I've never been to Nagasaki before. So this summer, we are going to Nagasaki. I've been to Hiroshima several times, but you know, not Nagasaki. Nagasaki is farther from Tokyo. And so definitely, I always wanted to go to Nagasaki. And then this year, this annual peace symposium will be held in Nagasaki. And very luckily that, you know, Yuki is a trip plan and my trip plan, you know, coincided. So she invited me to attend at the symposium, so that I'm really looking forward to it. But actually, There are many things that I'm looking forward to, but maybe I would say the thing that I'm looking forward to the most is to visit the specific museum called the Nagasaki Museum for Human Rights and Peace. And so this museum focusing on the Japanese Imperial Military's, you know, atrocities during World War II. So all those, you know, human rights violations and all those, you know, war crimes that was committed by Japanese military and Imperial Japan. So that part of the history is not talked and also educated in Japan, which I think is a very serious problem as well. So talking about this nuclear history, the bombing history, what we, this project, trying not to fall in, right? Or actively try to address is that this nationalist framework doesn't work, right? So we don't want to go into the simplistic dichotomy, US as aggressor, Japan as a poor victim.
And how you hold these critiques in mind, because as you're saying, it's a very simple psychological defense too, good, bad, this is the perpetrator, these are the victims, and how to hold these critiques in mind at the same time. Yeah. It would be wonderful to have you all back on the show and perhaps reporting, doing a field trip report on our program again, maybe when school starts, and to talk further about your project. Before we close, can one of you tell us where listeners can access or find the Paper Crane project? I know you sent me a website and we'll post that. Would someone like to spell out the website?
So we have a website. It's teachnuclearhistory.com, but teach should be spelled with double A. So teachnuclearhistory.com. The reason why double A is because this project is also inspired by TEACH Act. It's a TEAACH Act. TEACH, Equitable Asian American Community History Act. So that's why we use that in our website. So please go to the teachnuclearhistory.com. So we are now uploading the latest, you know, achievement from this 2023-24 school year, right? So the students' work will be uploaded, and so please take a look.
We have many teachers among our listeners for the Old Mole Variety Hour who I know will be inspired and educated by your materials here. So thank you so much, Aiko Kojima Habino, Laura Gluckman, and Yuki Miyamoto, for joining me on the Old Mole Variety Hour today. It's been wonderful to have you. And we also encourage listeners to attend the Hiroshima Remembrance event at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland, 6 to 7:30 p.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, August 6th. This annual event is free and open to the public. Well, thanks so much to all of you for joining me here today. And I look forward to furthering our work and building those bridges where we can.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having us.
That was Jan Hawken talking with Aiko Kojima Kabino, Laura Gluckman, and Yuki Miyamoto for the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Community Radio. And from 1969, Time is Tight, a 45 by Booker T and the MGs. Up next, Bill Resnick in conversation with Peter Sullenberger for the Old Mole Variety Hour, comparing views in a friendly debate on whether or not socialists should ever vote for the so-called lesser of two evils. How should socialists relate to the Democratic Party both in electoral seasons and quieter times? Here's Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Our variety, of course, is in the variety of the struggles from below that we cover. Today, we're going to do something very different than our usual interview. A debate. It's a debate on how socialists should relate to the Democratic Party, who have a history of prosecuting socialists, at minimum attacking and trying to disrupt socialists. But today's party main activity is trying to maintain and gain state power, which would, of course, require defeating the Republicans and the other capitalist party and imposing their program for stabilizing capitalism that frequently runs off the rails. Thus, in my lifetime, I've experienced depressions, deep recessions, scandals, wars with other capitalist nations, and wars at home with their own working class. That included police and vigilante murders of socialists that were unpunished. On the phone to debate with me is Peter Sullenberger, a dedicated socialist. Peter, give us a short intro to your work and life.
My name is Peter Sullenberger, and I'm a labor and social justice activist in Michigan. I spent most of my life in Detroit, and now I'm living in northern Michigan. I've been active all through my teens and adult life on projects from civil rights and stopping the Vietnam War to now Palestine and labor struggles, both local and national to the extent I can. I'm a member of Solidarity and a member of Tempest, both socialist organizations. Bill and I work together on publications, and I'm glad to be here.
Peter's adamant that we should not work with the Democratic Party, certainly never support their candidates, never practice lesser evilism, that is, the practice of voting for the lesser evil of the nominated by the two capitalist parties. But he recognizes the importance of participating in elections. He's very enthusiastic about independent left political party that would hopefully over the years gradually increase their vote. They would compete at every level of government, and that over the years are anchor itself in more and more cities and increase its votes across the country. Peter will contend for this position, and I will discuss my position, that we do in effect work with the Democratic Party and its constituent organizations, but very rarely support their candidates. Peter will contend for this position, and I will discuss my position, that we do in effect work with the party, but mostly its constituent organizations, but do it better. Very rarely, however, support their candidates. I'll go first in contending for my position, and then Peter will follow with his. But first, we drafted a short joint position, our overarching understanding of the world today. So Peter will read it to us.
Hi, folks. This is Peter Sullenberger. I'm reading a joint statement that Bill and I agreed on, which shows our common view, which in fact is much bigger than our differences. This is the statement. Capitalism is swiftly moving on a death march for humans and the planet. Climate change, pandemics, inevitable sooner or later, a virus is lethal and easily transmissible. The chemical time bomb with long-lasting non-natural chemicals taking permanent residence in our bodies and reacting to create a toxic chemical, perhaps the accidental or intentional triggering of nuclear weapons. And daily life is becoming more precarious, alienating, and crazy-making. At the same time, we know what must be done. In short, first, to fight in every political contest. Second, to build left movements and a mass working-class political party challenging capital, with a vision of that better, necessary, sustainable, and radically democratic world. But we differ on how that can be done in electoral seasons like the one now upon us. That was the statement we agreed on, summarizing our deeply shared view of the general political situation.
Thanks, Peter, for the joint statement. Now, I'll offer my position on dealing with the Democratic Party. Dealing with the party raises many issues. One issue is, should socialists ever support a Democratic Party candidate? For the coming election, I say yes, but only in the swing states, Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, Pennsylvania, maybe some others that are not securely locked away by one party or the other. Another issue is how one would, in fact, improve Harris's chances of winning the election and do it in the swing states. I think socialists should vote for Harris in those states, but as a lesser evil. And we should point out that the Democratic Party has cooperated with the Republicans in undermining unions, increasing prison sentences, cutting the taxes of rich people and corporations, reducing help for the poor, and much more of the neoliberal agenda, enriching the rich. Still, the Dems are not autocrats and would allow critique of those in power as opposed to their opponents in the coming presidential election. Another issue in relating with the Democrats has to do with we deal with the Democratic Party Progressive Caucus in the Congress. I think we should support Bernie Sanders, the Squad, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but also point out the compromises they make to maintain the party legitimacy in the struggle with the MAGA forces that run Donald Trump's Republican Party. Here's another issue, how to work with the Democrats in non-electoral seasons. My answer is the same way we do it now, but more effectively. That's because for nearly all the revolutionary socialists work in reform organizations alongside rank and file Democrats. They're fighting for Democrats democratizing unions, racial justice, Black Lives Matter, jobs with justice, myriad reproductive rights, and local and national environmental struggles, especially over climate change. These Democrats are not hostile to socialism. Indeed, these Democrats in the movements are radically inclined people who make up the majority of U.S. North Americans in polls. They favor the word socialism. It has connotations more favorable to them than the word capitalism, deepening their socialist commitment, pretty shallow but still there, would enormously strengthen this country's socialist movements. Of course, this effort to politicize more the millions of young Americans and older who are active in all of those movements, it cannot resemble the effort of some on the revolutionary left to focus on the most capable movement activists and then try to steal them to their particular political party. That gets us a terrible registration in the movements and a suspicion of leftists who are critical of capitalism and the way, in fact, they create the problems that the movements are committed to deal with. Then I'll do a paragraph on non-reform or revolutionary reform that the movements can win, and reforms that reinforce the fundamental knowledges and understandings that are at the root of socialist commitments and that strengthen the left movements. That would be my sense of how to relate to the Dems. So, Peter, give us a sense of how you would relate to the Democrats.
Well, much of what you said, Bill, I simply agree with. I work with Democrats all the time in unions, Palestine solidarity work, and many other movements. Also over a referenda, for example, to put abortion and reproductive rights in the Michigan Constitution. My difference is over partisan elections for office. In those, I advocate voting for Jill Stein, Cornel West, and the Greens in whatever combination they emerge to popularize the idea of an alternative to the capitalist parties. I recognize that a third of voters won't vote. A third will vote for Kamala Harris. A third will vote for Donald Trump. A few swing voters will determine the outcome of the election, and only a few hundred thousand at most will vote for the independents, that is, for the Greens and possibly Cornel West separately. I wouldn't try to persuade those who want to vote for Harris or Trump or who want to abstain to do anything else. I would discuss the issues with them if the circumstances were right. Bill said that it's possible to win reforms, and I agree, but the question is how? And it seems to me that mass action is the main way to win reforms, not elections. The elections at best show the balance of class forces. They can aid in the development of consciousness, but they mainly reflect achievements that have already been won by mass action. The main use for Marxists of elections now is to promote ideas while people are thinking about politics. The Democrats and Republicans are capitalist parties, as Bill has said. They are committed to maintaining the capitalist order. They're dependent on capitalist donors and the capitalist media. They are part of a milieu of business people, politicians, government officials, military officers, media figures, academics that are all committed to and make their living from capitalism. The two parties agree on all of the fundamentals, on capitalist property, on the military, police, prisons, borders, Social Security, Medicare as reforms that they need to control the working class, and public education. The Dems tend to be more liberal. The Republicans tend to be more conservative. But it's a two-party system at the national level in particular, I'm talking about, that works by an alternation of Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats disappoint, the voters throw the bums out. The Republicans disappoint, the voters throw the bums out. And it's that alternation that keeps people thinking, I've got some control in this situation, and the reality isn't. The two-party system, the separation of powers, federalism, mean that the government will only do what a consensus or preponderance of the ruling class wants. Now, similar policies emerge with Democrats and Republicans in office. Looking at the Trump and Biden administrations, their policy on the COVID bailout was very similar. Each of them contributed $3.5 trillion to the bailout. They have similar positions on the military budget, on trade. The Trump tariffs have been maintained by Biden, and Biden has doubled down on an industrial policy to continue the competition with China. They voted together on immigration, on infrastructure. They don't agree on immigration, but the practice is the same. If refugees make it into the U.S., asking for asylum, the policy now of the Biden administration is send them back to Mexico, get rid of them. It's the Trump policy. The views on the environment are different, but the policies are very similar. The Biden administration has approved many, many gas, oil, fracking licenses. They're not taking the actions necessary to stop it. On police, too, the policies are similar. They both fund the police, even breaking up homeless encampments. Gavin Newsom has started that, and in Chicago they're starting that, breaking up homeless encampments, same policy as the Republicans. The Democrats are the lesser evil in this election, especially on abortion rights, but the outcome of the fight over abortion will be determined more by the Underground Railroad of resistance than by the outcome of this election. The election, whatever happens, is going to have half the state saying yes, half the state saying no, and an effort by women and women supporters, supporters of human rights, to undermine the Republican state's attempts to prevent abortion. Marxists have very limited resources. I think in general we shouldn't put much into elections at all, and Bill is more or less saying that when he's saying in this election, call for the support of Harris in the swing states. Mainly what we need to do, I think, is to try to popularize the idea that there can be an alternative to the capitalist parties and their alternation in the two-party system. And that, I think, means getting as big a vote as possible for the Greens everywhere. And the difference in Michigan, where I live, in the vote that Marxists can bring about is very small. I think it's more important that increase the vote for the Greens challenging the Democrats than whatever little bit it can do in altering the outcome of the vote in the state. For me personally, I conscientiously object to voting for evil, even if it's the lesser evil, but I don't really try to impose that on other people. What I want to discuss with people is the issues, and to say calmly, what I advocate is vote for an alternative to the capitalist parties, because that's what we need in elections, an alternative. The main fight, though, is not in elections. It's in the movements, the unions, and the social movements.
Okay, that was a thorough evisceration of the Dems. I agree we need a left political party, but I have a sense that, well, it's good to have a opposition and that argues what the same arguments that you made. But I think we have a chance of growing a left political party would be to spend a lot of effort on ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting, it seems to me, is put you on the ballot and give people a chance to feel that their vote is not wasted. So, I mean, that's another addition. I don't disagree with your challenge to the Democrats, but it seems to me it would be more strategic way, an added strategic way for the goal of dynamic left at large and political party.
All right. Well, I enjoyed getting my thoughts together and having the exchange. Thank you, Bill.
Okay. Thank you. Hi, folks. I have a few remarks to close out this debate, replying to Peter Sullenberger's critique and recommendations. Peter argues that the differences in the two major parties are insignificant. They both support capitalism, persecute the socialist left. In this election, the differences are significant, it seems to me, especially about climate change. Democrats would attempt to reduce fossil fuel burning. The other slogan is drill, baby, drill. Peter attacks voting for the lesser evil under any circumstances. He contends that we should vote for one of the independent left political parties. But in this election, lesser evil voting in the swing states makes sense. For those who passionately desire and are working towards building a left political party that's growing because of the appeal of its vision, I recommend committing resources into winning ranked choice voting systems to determine the winner in their city. In that ranked choice system, a left party could thrive because the initial report of the voting, the number of votes for the left candidate, would be counted if it wasn't more than half the winner, and then added to the total of their second choice. And ultimately, if they accumulate second and third and fourth choice, the left party gains state power.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for the 5th of August, 2024. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken, and to their guests, Peter Sullenberger, Aiko Kojima Kabino, Laura Gluckman, and Yuki Miyamoto. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Query. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.